I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at an initiative from Christian Theological Seminary. It's called the Faith in Action Project. It aims to fund ways to make lasting reductions in poverty rates here, particularly among children. My guests are Jay Gachet, he's an advisory board member, Faith in Action Project, Leah Gunning Francis, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Christian Theological Seminary, and Lindsay Rabinowitch, Project Director, Faith in Action Project. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about Christian Theological Seminary's Faith in Action Project, which focuses on finding innovative ways to combat poverty. Conversation probably at some point will morph into a larger discussion of poverty and its effects on both individuals and the community. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jay Gachet. He is advisory board member for the Faith in Action Project. Leah Gunning Francis. She is vice president of academic affairs at Christian Theological Seminary. And Lindsay Rabinowitch, Project Director at the Faith in Action Project. I can't talk. That's a liability in radio. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. So, Lindsay, I'm going to start with you, largely because your colleagues here said you're the one who has all the answers. Talk to me about what Faith in Action, what the project is, what it sets out to do.
Well, thanks, John. The Faith in Action Project is dedicated to inspiring and convening and connecting organizations, faith communities, and others to implement effective strategies to those confronting poverty. We know that there are a lot of great things already underway in Indianapolis, but what we see is that we needed to come together and collaborate, work with the city and the administration, and come up with strategies to help mobilize community and really address the issues at hand that are going to bring people out of poverty and break the cycle.
So walk me through, how does it work specifically? I mean, what are the pieces here?
The Faith in Action Project has two cornerstone events. So we have our fall event, which is always a set of marquee speakers that are there to raise awareness about the issues, and that will be held this fall, perhaps in October or November. The idea is that we bring the community together, we provoke and inspire them and want them to make a call to action. And then in the spring is where we have a day-long conference where we bring leaders that are on the front lines, faith leaders, nonprofit leaders. We bring them together and we talk about what are best practices to addressing poverty and how do we come together and look at it more innovative approaches.
I'll throw the next one to Jay. How do you select these leaders?
So are you speaking the leaders for the grants themselves or for the speaker series?
Why don't we start with the grants?
Sure. So the grant process was an open grant process. As Lindsay talked about, we had a wonderful spring conference where we kind of took the idea of poverty and really developed it from multiple different speakers. And so we were so pleased that the mayor's Hogsett office was there with Reverend David Hampton, tremendous speaker, but the keynote speaker was Bob Lumpton, who wrote Toxic Charity. And so a lot of great speakers there, but that open process really then brought people to the forefront who wanted to apply We did not, it was not an invitation process, it was an open process. And so these are the leaders that came forward with these applications for these innovative ways to tackle poverty, really self-selected and said, we're in, and then wrote their application, their letter of intent. That was narrowed down to the 14, and then it's being narrowed down further with the further selection process. So self-selecting.
Leah, why is this a priority for Christian Theological Seminary, and how did it you arrive at making this a concentrated effort?
This kind of effort cuts right to the heart of what we understand so much of our theological mission to be about. We know that the study of theology is more than just a theoretical process, but one that we want to have very deep and abiding practical application for our students and for the community. And so when the Mike and Sue Smith Foundation approached us about this idea and wanting to house this within Christian Theological Seminary because of their own faith commitments, their own commitments to service in the Indianapolis community, we knew it was a really good fit. And it's just a great way to bring together the best of who we understand and what we understand our faith to be about, which is faith that is put into action.
That you anticipated my next question, Leah. I'm going to stay with you, which is, how did you arrive at the name? And I'm curious as to why you decided to go with the and rather than in.
Yeah.
Why you went with a condition rather than a preposition.
Well, the faith, names were tossed around quite a bit, but we didn't want people to say faith in action and start to make that a play to say, oh, yeah, faith in action. You know, it's not in action, but, you know, and not separate the three words. And so we went with faith and action to be able to have a distinct, you know, that this is something active and something vital and something integral to what we're about.
So go ahead, jump on in.
And if I may add to it, when the board came together, they really wanted us to focus on solution-oriented ideas. We did not want to just have a speaker series. We wanted a learning opportunity for then the public to go and implement these strategies. And the Mike and Sue Smith family felt if they were going to continue their funds and in support of this program, they wanted to make sure that there was community engagement. And that is the action. That's putting your faith in action. And so that's those key principles are what led us to that name selection.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about Christian Theological Seminary's Faith and Action Project here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So first, a couple of basic questions. What is the funding for a project like this? How large is it funded? I'm assuming everybody's looking in your direction, Lindsay. So
the Mike and Sue Smith Family Foundation came to CTS a few years ago and brought this project and this idea. They are the sole funders. We have a commitment from them to be the sole funders for a few years, although we've been approached by a few foundations wanting to partner with us, and that is under consideration. I think that the partnership would be great financially, but even more, I think what it would do is bring more awareness around the issues and what needs to happen to address adequate housing and workforce development, all the issues, the dimensions of poverty that we need to address. So in terms of funding, the Mike and Sue Smith family is ready to move forward individually, although we are considering other funders. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I wanted to add something about the CTS involvement in this and why they're uniquely special in this space. You know, the poverty is a very complex issue. It has many different dimensions, as Lindsay talked about. And so this idea of collaboration is so key. And I think what CTS brings to the table and the desire of the Mike and Sue Smith Family Foundation was really to pull together a collaborative effort between faith and other not-for-profits. And so through the application process, you'll see in almost every one, there's a church involved or a faith component involved, as well as a not-for-profit or other type of institution that you may normally see tackling these complex problems. But that collaboration was part of the early vision. And I think CTS is one of the unique entities that can pull that together for us.
And I'll ask this of any of the three who feels moved to speak. Mm-hmm. How are you measuring success with these approaches or proposals? Because, poverty has been a focus in this nation for much of the past century. What are the metrics we're using here to determine if any of this is working? They're looking in your direction again, Lindsay.
Measuring impact is very important. Right now, in terms of the project success, we like to measure it by how many people are attending the events, how many people are engaged in our small gatherings, what faith communities that we have, their attention, and they're reaching out to us even more, and the nonprofit communication. We do have a newsletter, so the openings of the newsletter and how people are reading it. But we want to go beyond that. We really want to see quality applications, which we were very affirmed in our thinking that great work is going on in Indianapolis by the program summaries that we read in the first round of this grant application. What we'd like to see is the finalists that are chosen, that we can use the resources through the Faith in Action Project to scale up these projects, and then that we would help them by providing data and additional resources so that they can be measuring their impact and looking at their outcomes, the short-term outcomes and long-term outcomes.
Yeah, Jay.
Just a comment to add on to what Lindsay said. With each application that was submitted, there was a significant component on the outcomes they expected. Not just number of lives touched, but it could go into how was their income increased or their credit rating increased. And so each of the applications specified what outcomes they would measure. And, of course, we'll hold them to that as we review and partner with them going forward.
Is there an academic component to this? I mean, is it part of your curriculum at CTS?
We are always reviewing and looking at ways to offer the kind of courses that are deeply relevant to these sort of commitments. And so this upcoming year, as we have put out our course schedule, to have courses that are engaging both the Bible and issues of poverty and the practical application of those things. Absolutely. We see this as a great way to sort of expand our educational mission, if you will, as we seek to bring it inside the school as well as put it out into the community.
In terms of the impact question that we're talking about, I mean, with these community leaders, how do you go about reaching out to them to get them, make them aware of the possibilities of these grants or, even the possibility of this greater, it sounds like another primary focus of this program is information sharing, getting people to be talking across lines and break down silos.
Well, John, our first fall event, we had 2,000 people attend, and it was with David Brooks and Tavis Smiley. And so that was a great opportunity that we could share about the Faith in Action Project. And those individuals then followed along with our newsletter, and we kept them informed with our project and as well as just really the recent news about poverty and anti-poverty efforts.
I would say I think the fall event is key in the awareness of the opportunity. And so we announced the application process at the fall event. And when you have national speakers like a Tavis Smiley or a David Brooks, the awareness goes up, and then you have the opportunity to make them aware of the grants underneath that. And so we recognize that it's a growing awareness, and we hope next year will be even larger than this year.
Have you started selecting the speakers yet for this fall's event? Yeah. You want to break it with us?
Well, I think I can. We can highlight who we are speaking with, and if they don't attend our event in terms of scheduling, I would highlight them in the fact that they are amazing individuals doing anti-poverty work. Matthew Desmond with Evicted, he wrote that book. And on housing, Raj Jetty, and he is a Stanford professor and has a lot of ideas about how to address poverty, and Debbie Bial. So we are looking forward to working with those speakers and hopefully bringing them to Indianapolis.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Christian Theological Seminary's Faith and Action Project, which aims at combating poverty in Indianapolis and elsewhere. My guests are Jay Gachet. He is an advisory board member for the Faith and Action Project. Leah Gunning Francis, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Christian Theological Seminary, and Lindsay Rabinowitz, Project Director, Faith and Action Project. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about an initiative of the Christian Theological Seminary to combat poverty in Indianapolis and Indiana. It's called the Faith and Action Project. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jay Gachet. He is an advisory board member of the Faith and Action Project. Leah Gunning Francis, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Christian Theological Seminary. And Lindsay Rabinowitz, Project Director of the Faith and Action Project. That last CH thing seems to be catching on my tongue here. We've got an email question from our regular listener, Jerry. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, Governor Holcomb boasted in his inaugural address that Indiana is number one in manufacturing. He neglected to mention that we are number 31 in median family income. Is this part of the problem? And he says a related question, do panelists think that Jesus of Nazareth regarded health care as a human right? We'll deal, Jerry, with the first question first, and then I guess I'll throw the last one to Leah. So is the fact that we're number one in manufacturing but number 31 in median family income part of the problem? Jay, I'll start with you, just because you put your pen down.
Absolutely.
First.
So I would say that the average family income, the median family income, is a critical issue. Right. And so sustaining employment and livable wages are key to help people out of poverty. And so for us to be ranked 31st, I think whenever you're in the bottom half, that's never a good place to be. And I do know that several administrations have had a goal of trying to raise that median income. And so, yes, it is related. It is not something that our state should be proud of. And to effectively raise that median income should be job one for any administration as well.
And Lindsay, do you have any thoughts you want to add to what Jay said? Or?
Well, the Brookings Institute has shown that we are the 15th worst in the country for concentrated poverty. And so that is just something we come back to. It's the alarm has gone off for us that this is just not acceptable for anyone. And so we really want to raise awareness and make an effort to make people want to take action and come together to find strategies to combat this.
And I want to talk about that larger question here. But I do not want to give Jerry's second question short shrift, so I'll throw that one to Leah real quickly. Would Jesus have considered health care a human right?
I think that the Bible helps us to see that so much of what Jesus did was about making sure that people were healed, they were whole, they were well. We look at people in the Bible who were had sight issues, blood issues, all manner of things that Jesus went about healing. And so absolutely, Jesus would consider this a human rights issue.
So I want to talk about this larger question of poverty. And ask, I guess I'll start the part of the conversation by asking whether this adds some urgency to the discussion and to the fact that you are trying to figure out new ways to unlock the door here, as it were. We're seeing things that historically we haven't seen before, where, you know, the jobs numbers in Indiana have gone up, but at the same time, the poverty rate has gone up. Normally, those were linked inversely, that, you know, when the jobless rate dropped, the poverty rate dropped as well. Now, there is an increasing sign that we've moved into a new era, perhaps, where, you know, getting close to full employment doesn't necessarily mean that you're really able to attack the problem of poverty. I'd like everyone's thoughts on this, because, you know, so much of our strategy was, if we find people jobs, we've solved the poverty problem. That doesn't seem to be the case right now. Lindsay, I'll start with you.
Well, I'll go back to this idea about concentrated poverty, because in these neighborhoods, there is more negative outcomes that they're experiencing, more crime, less quality education, more health challenges, higher school dropout rates. And so these individuals have a harder time, even if someone in there has a job, maybe they're not holding the job. They need quality jobs. So I really think that we need to address the concentrated poverty, and some of the issues in addressing this is giving them quality school, is giving them affordable housing options, giving them quality food options. And until we address those issues, that jobs are just one dimension of the whole issue.
Leah.
Yes, all of those things absolutely go together. We know that poverty is a multifaceted problem that requires a multifaceted solution. But we cannot overlook the fact that just having a job is not enough, as we know the data shows. But people have to have jobs that produce the kind of wages that they can sustain themselves and their families over time. So that is something that absolutely has to be continue to be addressed as we understand its impact on what it means for impoverished communities.
Jay.
I'd be interested at some data around this. Yes, jobs are increasing more, you know, right? But the jobs themselves have changed drastically over the years. And so the jobs that we had before are not necessarily the jobs that are available today. I remember some data coming out of the recession in 08 that showed that the jobs that were being created were a lower paying job, more service industry. But I know you were speaking more about manufacturing. And so,
well,
yes,
that was Jerry's question, much more. Mine is the larger dynamic.
Yeah, and so I guess I wonder about the question of underemployment. So are the skills that people bring allowing them to garner the wages that are the higher wages, or is it a lower paying job that is where those are coming back? And are the hours available also? So I think you have to dig down into that data set of information to really understand what's happening, because I think we're not where we were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think jobs have changed, and I think the employment benefits have changed, and the skills needed are dramatically changing.
We are talking about Christian Theological Seminary's Faith and Action Project. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much.
Certainly.
And again, thank you for helping us all figure out how to help. And congratulations to CTS. You guys, I grew up right around. Mom and Dad moved to Butler Tarkington so they could be close to CTS when they retired, and that's 30 or 40 years ago. So CTS continues to do wonderful things. Okay, I have one suggestion and then one question.
Sure.
One is, you mentioned your panelists and and groups you're bringing together are faith-based and nonprofit. I'd like to suggest firmly that you also include some a couple of business folks, business leaders, who are either working with the nonprofits and faith-based organizations already, or have taken initiative and are taking initiative on their own to do things in certain neighborhoods. And I'm thinking of one business person in particular who is beginning to be involved in the far east side, the 38th and Shadeland area. But he's kind of modest, and at the same time, when he does speak, he's inspirational. A number of teachers have had him come, because he himself grew up in poverty. He was homeless by 12, went on Vietnam vet, master's degree and undergraduate, and a few other accomplishments, and he is inspirational when he speaks.
Well, I suspect
the second thing is, if we have some local folks along those lines that we'd like to recommend for your panelists, with whom do we speak?
Thank you very much for the call and the question. I was anticipating, Margaret, that I'm guessing that all three of these folks would like to know the name of the business guy that you're talking about if they don't know it already and be put in touch with you. So maybe we'll get information for you to contact them. Thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
Thank you.
So let's deal with the question. A, are there business people involved in this? And if not, are there places for them to plug in? Lindsay, I'll throw that one to you.
Yes, absolutely. We need the business leaders. We need the people in power to help with the decision making so that it is an integrated approach to building these strategies. We also need them to be collaborating and communicating with the nonprofit leaders and the faith communities and the Black leaders. I really think it takes an approach by everyone. And in particular, we've talked about that the people in the communities need to be the ones telling the business leaders or the nonprofit leaders what they need, rather than having a top-down approach and saying, we're going to come to this community and build a new school. We need the community leaders to say, you know what, we really need a new grocery store, or we really need this. But working together to develop and implement and maintain those efforts really needs to come from the community standpoint.
And if people want to plug in, how do they go about getting in touch with you? For example, if Margaret wants to contact Faith, go ahead.
My email is L Rabinowitch, R-A-B-I-N-O-W-I-T-C-H at cts.edu. And they can get a hold of me that way.
Jay, you look like you wanted to say
something. I was just going to say, on the advisory board with myself, there are other business leaders that are there. And so the voice is there. I was trying to remember who attended the conference. Obviously, there were many business leaders who were in the audience at Clues last fall, but in the conference there were some. But I would say underrepresented, and I think that is good advice and things that we need, something we need to work on stronger in the coming year.
Is that part of the challenge or the problem? I mean, I'm going to ask a question that really wasn't, but has flowed out of Margaret's and this conversation. You know, a generation ago, you know, to get things done and to mobilize the business community in Indianapolis and central Indiana, you pretty much had to make one call, and that was to get Tom Binford on board. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone who has kind of stepped into that role, or is that part of the problem is that we have a vacuum of someone who is serving that role of kind of being the conscience of the business community. Mm-hmm. Jay, I'll start with you on that.
Oh, I would just say, from my experience with my wonderful days at United Way of Central Indiana, mm-hmm. the business community of Central Indiana is wonderfully supportive of the efforts of like this initiative, mm-hmm. Anti-Poverty, or other philanthropic activities. The companies, whether it be Eli Lilly or other companies across the spectrum, are just tremendous supporters. I wouldn't say there's one person today. I would say there's many. And it depends on which area of town you're in, what the specific cause is that you're desiring to raise awareness and initiative around. And so thankfully, what Mr. Binford did many years ago, I think many people have adopted and are leading today. But I would say there are many rather than just one.
Leah.
And what we hope this initiative does is inspire our local businesses to find the leaders within. As Jay just said, there's not just one person out there who can, you know, speak for everyone or on behalf of everyone, but that others might see the ways in which this is energizing. This is a very viable opportunity to bring together corporate, not-for-profit, faith community in a way where there is a role for everyone to play.
Is there someone, and I'm, to be fair to Tom Binford and his legacy, I don't think he would argue that he spoke for the entire business community of Indianapolis, but he was someone that the perception was if you could get him engaged in the way you were going to solve the problem, mm-hmm. others would follow mm-hmm. with that. Is there anyone who provides that kind of leadership at the macro level now, or is that something that would serve the community well? I'll throw that one to Lindsay.
I still don't know of someone that is just one person. I agree that there's many. But I will say our donor, Mike Smith, is very connected. And from his experience in the business world, he makes one phone call and people are ready to listen and ready to meet with us. And so that's how we've had a lot of opportunities to go in front of people and explain our project and our mission.
So, yes, Jay.
I just wanted to add one thing. You know, we talked about the not-for-profits. We talked about businesses. One of the things that Faith in Action is trying to do also is to really engage the people who are in poverty and making sure that they have a voice in the direction of this effort as well. Because you can do it to people or you can do it with people. And my experience is doing it with people works much better.
How do they make their voices heard in this process?
Yeah. So one way is we are actually aggressively looking for people to represent on the advisory board. Mm-hmm. And so that is a pursuit. I think through all the applications, we looked very strongly at one of the criteria was community involvement in the solution. And we rated them based upon how were the voices and the needs of the community represented in the proposal itself.
So let me ask this, and it's probably a basic question. How many applications did you get, and how many did you choose to support, Lindsay?
We received 54 letters of intent and program summaries, and 14 were selected.
And how did you go about? What was the process of selection? Who did that?
Well, we had a review committee, and the review committee looked at the applications, and as Jay mentioned, we looked at, were members of the community, those in poverty, were their voices part of developing the plans to implement the solutions to poverty? Were they producing stability? Were these programs producing stability in the lives of those in poverty? Was there mentoring or education components a part of the solution to poverty? And are these evidence-based solutions in terms of when we're looking at outcomes and impact, we want to make sure that we are using evidence-based solutions and models moving forward.
We are talking about Christian Theological Seminary's initiative to combat poverty. It's called the Faith and Action Project. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jay Gachet. He is an advisory board member for the Faith in Action Project. Leah Gunning-Francis. She is vice president of academic affairs at Christian Theological Seminary. And Lindsay Rabinowitch. She is project director for the Faith and Action Project. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits.
Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about an initiative from the Christian Theological Seminary to combat poverty. It is called the Faith in Action Project. My guests are Jay Gachet. He is an advisory board member for the Faith in Action Project. Leah Gunning Francis, she is vice president of academic affairs at Christian Theological Seminary. And Lindsay Rabinowitz, she is project director for Faith in Action Project. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ryan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Great
Certainly.
Show.
Thanks very much. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm going to be blunt. If you look at the policies the Republican Party blocked, proposed, pushed, passed, add as amendments, and sneak in as riders to must-pass bills, you will see they're doing everything possible to keep people poor. For example, cleaning up polluted areas within those communities, cuts to schools, cuts to housing, and cuts to food stamps, health care, doing everything to suppress their vote by closing libraries, B&Bs, and polling locations. They're also making IDs harder to get because the poor people don't have time to chase down everything needed to get IDs. And there's the judicial aspect to the whole thing. Why? They typically vote for Democrats. We will not end poverty with Republicans in control at the state and federal offices. They keep saying faith-based organizations can fill that void, but the need is too great, or we wouldn't be having this conversation today. That's what I have to say.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ryan. And I will say it so that the three of you don't have to. I'm presuming this is a nonpartisan effort and initiative. We've gotten a related question via Twitter, and again, you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. Listener tweeted, how do you view the marriage of Christianity and conservatism with their opposition to welfare and obsession with personal responsibility? What are you doing to make sure that those living in poverty have a voice in the solution? Because we haven't talked about this component. We've talked about, you know, the role of the faith-based community. We've talked about the role of not-for-profits. We've talked about the role of business even. But, you know, the other leg to that table is government. What is the role, what is the responsibility of government in dealing with poverty, and is that explored? I'll start with Jay, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on
this.
And I particularly want to hear Leah's thoughts on the question about the marriage of Christianity and conservatism.
Yeah, those are big questions, and so let me share some personal views on this as well. I do not believe the faith-based community can solve these problems alone. I don't believe the not-for-profit community can solve these problems alone. These problems are too big, they're too costly, and they have been festering and developing for too long. I believe government has a definite role in it. And so how much bigger of a role, I think, is debatable, and what are the rights that are due our residents is also debatable. As I talk to people, that spectrum of belief of, is it personal choice that causes the problem, or is it the system that causes the problem, or a combination of both someplace in between? Those are the big questions. I advocate for government to be a key role in it, and they have some definite levers and incentives that can drive behavior and progress. But those are my personal views.
Okay. Lindsay. I'm going to give Leah the last word on the whole faith question, marriage of Christianity and conservatism. But Lindsay, I'd like your thoughts on the role of government in combating poverty.
Well, I think that the government are the decision makers, and they need to be making good decisions on the access to quality transportation, quality jobs, quality schools, workforce development, economic development. And we have been just blessed with the way that Mayor Hogsett has made poverty a top priority in his administration and is supportive of our initiative. And I think he wants to encourage these decisions to be made to combat poverty.
Okay, Leah, you're up now.
Now, although the Faith in Action Project is an interfaith project, it's housed at Christian Theological Seminary, which is obviously a Christian seminary. And one of the things that our primary text, which is the Bible, makes very clear is that Jesus always stood on the side of the marginalized and the oppressed. And so one of the things I love so much about our work in theological education is how we bring multiple voices to the table to really be able to investigate these biblical truths alongside of the practical issues of life and come up with the kind of ethic that will enable all people in our society to be able to live in a way that is fair and just. So this issue of sort of the wedding of Christianity and conservatism, it's a curious one because by no means is that lens the only way that many conservatives have interpreted Scripture is the only way to do so. There's plenty of evidence throughout the entire Bible that makes very clear the kinds of things in which Jesus sought to hold their government accountable, to keep them honest, if you will, on behalf of people that were poor and disenfranchised.
I've gotten a tweet from a listener named David. And again, if you want to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. David writes, who are the neighborhood grassroots leaders you feel most excited about in Indy? I'll throw that one to Lindsay first. I imagine there's some of the folks who are getting your project, your grants.
Yes, we wanted to make sure we represented a diversity of size and location to the organizations that we asked to move forward in the grant process. And there were a few grassroots organizations. ProAct Indy was one where they provide kids service opportunities while providing them with life skills training. We had Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, excuse me. They have an Adopt-a-Block program on the east side area, and they really use that to build a stronger community. We have Achieve International, which is directly trying to educate individuals, disadvantaged youth, and also helping them build self-motivation, dedication to boxing. Those are a few of our organizations. The one that really, one of the few that stands out to me is Purposeful Design. It's a very grassroots organization and employs men who have emerged from addiction, homelessness, and trains them to make handcrafted customer furniture. And they also make sure that they are employed and they are mentoring them through their time as they re-entry out of prison. And that happens over several years, not just a year, and then they move on to someone else. So we're very excited about some of these grassroots organizations that have emerged.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Beth. And again, if you want to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Beth writes, John, another measurement of success would be forthtelling. Please note that I attended both the kickoff fall event and the spring day-long programming. Ideas and experiences changed at Faith in Action prompted me to contact Chris Gall of Visit Indy and Bob Schultz of Downtown Indy, both of whom were on the show just a few days ago, talking about the Indianapolis's big weekend, through No Limits to propose new programming for neighbors of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Social change is a continual work in progress. It is key for persons to recognize the opportunity to change landscapes. So how much of the focus here really is irrespective of the dollars, the grants? Mm-hmm. It it is, you know, it sounds like the real subtext I'm hearing here is that you want to get a lot of people who have the capacity, and I don't just mean financial capacity, but intellectual capacity, moral capacity, all of that, to affect change in the same room and focused on this problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start with Jay, just because he's looking in my direction.
Oh, absolutely. So awareness is a huge component. Reaching the tipping point, whatever that tipping point is, getting people to think about these problems and therefore come up with solutions, those are all outcomes that are probably immeasurable. But if you look at faith in action, one of the key ideas is let's get smart people thinking about the problems who weren't thinking about it before, perhaps, and get them to come up with new or expanded solutions.
Leah.
Faith in action also serves as a vehicle through which we can start to offer a counter-narrative about poverty. Too often, the dominant narrative is one that says, why don't people just pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Why don't they just do better or make better choices? When we know, as we've all said, that this is a multifaceted problem. And so to see so many different facets of the community coming together to say, yes, poverty is our problem. It is not just the problem of an individual or of one community. And know that community or those individuals cannot merely pull themselves up by their bootstraps simply because none of us have ever pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. There's always been support to help people get where they need to go. And so we also hope that the educative value of this is one that helps change that narrative about poverty.
Gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Andrea. And again, if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Andrea writes, this year, Indiana passed Senate Bill 558, which makes it impossible for cities to require affordable housing units be made available. Can you talk a little bit about how housing instability contributes to poverty rates increasing in Indiana? Lindsay, I know you've made reference to affordable housing several times during this program. I suspect that one's in your wheelhouse and you would like to speak to it.
When children don't have the security of a stable household, they are not as effective in participating in school. And they're also moving around and they can't build relationships. So then it's hard to have a consistent mentor. We really need affordable housing, and that's taken notice from a lot of organizations. Edmund Martin Christian Center is working with Eastern Star Church right now to help with stable households. There are other organizations that have made that a priority, and we want to make sure that that is one of the dimensions that is touched upon. We know that there are several, but we want the affordable housing and adequate, and they also, evidence data is showing that we want to make sure that there is residential segregation so that we are coming together or in our different diversity, people coming together and living together, different income levels, so it's not the concentrated poverty that we're seeing right now.
Are we seeing out of this any approaches, you know, interdisciplinary or integrated, that are actually making some headway, that seem to be turning the tide? I'll start with Lindsay on that.
You mean a model that we're seeing that has been really effective?
Yeah.
Well, I know that it's in the Denver region. They are trying to, with the Mile High Connects, it's working more on transportation. But if you have adequate transportation, you get to good housing and great jobs. I know in Chicago and Baltimore, they're finding ways to be more strategic about using housing subsidies to increase options for those low-income individuals. We really don't have one model that we hold up and say this is the right way to do it, and so we're really exploring and learning as much as we can.
So there are a couple. Go ahead, Jay.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know,
I don't think there's a silver bullet. I don't think there's a silver one thing that's just knocking it out of the park. But I think we do know that education is key. And I think our city has embraced that as a key solution, whether it be through pre-K all the way through vocation and college. I think that's key. I think job training is key. All those things that can provide stable income that is a livable wage. Housing is a part of that stability that is critical. And if the government focuses on bricks and mortar, we definitely need more bricks and mortar. But that has been they've been moving away from that, as our caller Andrea mentioned.
So in terms of where this goes, I mean, presumably you choose the speakers because you want to focus on a certain kind of aspect. What do you see as the most problematic piece of this? And I hate to reduce something that involves so much human suffering to a word like puzzle, but in some ways it is just a dramatically important puzzle that we have to figure out. What is the most critical piece for us to solve? Leah, I'll start with you.
I think just the pervasiveness of it is that it is widespread in so many different kinds of ways and cutting across so many prescribed barriers that we need to face that head on and deal with that hard reality.
Go ahead, Lindsay, and then Jay.
Yeah.
This is intergenerational poverty. So the new approaches really talk about two-generational approach. So we're helping the child with education, stable housing. We're helping the adult, the parents, the caregivers with training and workforce development. So you really have to take the approach for the two-generational approach to get the family to upward mobility.
Jay.
Yeah, we can talk about education, skill development, income. I think it comes down to hope. Do people have hope that they can have a better life? Do they have hope that tomorrow will be different than today? And I think we as a society owe it to allow people to have that hope and give them a hand up, not a handout.
So let me ask you, people are listening to this and they think, wow, this is a great project. I'd like to be involved. I'd like to volunteer. I'd like to do something. Are there opportunities for them to plug in and work on the Faith in Action project? And if so, how would they go about expressing that interest and getting involved? Lindsay.
Since we are not a service provider, we recommend getting involved in your faith community, getting involved in organizations that are currently working in the areas of those impoverished. And we encourage you to attend our events, our fall event. The date of that will be announced this summer, and we encourage you to come and learn.
Well, I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank all three of my guests, Jay Gachet, Leah Gunning-Francis, and Lindsay Rabinowitch, for what has been a lively and provocative conversation about an important issue. I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.